Okay, today is Saturday, the 12th of August, 2006. This is the Socialist Party of Great Britain, a debate between Bill Martin and Gwyn Thomas, both party members, who will be discussing the question of where real power lies in capitalism. My name is Tristan Miller, I'll be chairing the meeting, and the format will be as follows. First, Bill will give his opening statement, which may last, about 40 minutes around then. Then we'll take time for questions. Then we'll have a short tea break. When we reconvene, Gwyn will give his opening statement. And again, we'll have time for questions. We may have another short break before we go to a wind-up and any closing questions. So, without further ado then, I will invite Bill Martin to take the floor.
Thank you, Comrade Chair, fellow workers. The question today is, where does the real power lie in capitalism? The debate stems partly from some recent events within the Socialist Party where the Executive Committee chided the Socialist Standard Production Committee for an editorial which said that the real power does not lie in elected bodies. The debate further extends and possibly been within the party for a good long time and essentially stems from possible contradiction between two of our declarations of principles. Number four, that is, in the order of social evolution, the working class is the last class to achieve its freedom. Emancipation will involve emancipation. Oh, sorry, no, not one. Five. I thought it was on the report. This emancipation must be the work of the working class itself. We can edit the tape later to understand better. The emancipation must be the work of the working class itself. And number six, that the state may be converted from, including the armed forces, be converted from an instrument of oppression into the agent of emancipation. And it's the contradiction between this apparent the state as the agent of emancipation and the working class themselves that has been a continuing running sore within the party for many years. And of course, those of you around remember, it was at least in the background of the infamous controversy of Camden and North West London branches eventual expulsion. And of course, since the Field Objective Declaration of Principles is the basis of our party, it's no wonder that if there's a contradiction there, or apparent one, that members may themselves find themselves taking different sides in a dispute. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to look at how first to define real power, specifically within the context of what is real power in capitalism. I'm then going to mention the form or the essential human characteristic of authority within human communities, and how, in capitalism, it's the working class that has the real power. I'm then going to look at the apparent contradiction of this, which is the state and its control in society, and how the capitalist class manages to control that state, and I'm going to look at a model for how this is achieved. I'm then going to look at how this relates to our model of revolution. So, essentially, in the United Kingdom, at the very least, real power rests in the hands of Her Majesty the Queen. There's no doubt about that. She can, if she likes, appoint a Prime Minister. She can, if she likes, dissolve Parliament. She can, if she likes, veto laws and refuse to enact any of them. And in fact, also, she commands the armed forces. However, and I'll come back to this, in reality, she doesn't have complete control. The Act of Settlement gives Parliament the right to sack the Queen. But nonetheless, the Queen has the real power. Now, of course, power is capacity and ability immediately to do something. I, though you might regret it, have the power of speech. And I am using it at this moment. I have the power to leap over this table and punch Stan over there. Stan has the power to punch me back. And of course, you have the power to get in the way and stop me. And I do not have the power to punch everyone in this room. So there are clearly limits on what sort of power I exercise. But if I had an army at my side that I could control and send at you so that they would keep you out of the way while I punched Stan, then I would have a great deal of power over everyone in this room. That would be a very large extent of power. But it's also a power that extends beyond my physical body and becomes a form of social power. So what we're really looking at today is the exercise of social power and power in the abstract. And of course, my reference to the Queen is particularly pertinent because when we come to the question of what is real power, of course, the word real historically and etymologically, as anyone who follows European football would understand, means royal, as in the football team Real Madrid is Royal Madrid. And real things were royal. Real money was money that was sanctioned by royalty and had royal seal of approval. So that's what we can mean by real power. Now, of course, this brings us to what does real power mean in capitalism? Well, first off, we have to look back to previous modes of society. In previous modes of society, in tribalism, in early times, ancient times, the power, authority in the tribe would be held by elders, would be held by priests, and of a form, very different from the modern type, of religious kingship. Certainly in the very ancient Rome, they had, before the demise of the Tarquins, they had a sort of divine kingship that they would execute every year. In feudalism, power was exercised by the might of the sword. Power in society was exercised through the control of military violence. And this power took the form of extracting surplus product from peasants at the point of swords, being able to extract it from them, and from raiding other societies and taking away their movable goods, and being able to enforce your will through the force of arms on a neighbouring king or community. Now, this is very different from the way that power works in capitalism. In capitalism, power stems from the ownership of the means of production. It stems from having the wealth. And unfortunately, I didn't have time to actually source the quote, but there is a famous quote about one capitalist, I think in America, saying he didn't worry about the workers because he could always pay one half to put the other half down. Ultimately, property rules in capitalism. And as Marx noted or theorised, something called commodity fetishism, where relations between people become relations between things. In feudalism, power in society was exercised as a personal relationship, ultimately with the monarch, and the monarch was fetishized. In capitalism, it is capital and money and property that is fetishized and dominates over us. And this leads to what might appear to be an essential fault line in my talk, because I said earlier, working class have the real power, and yet a lot of the talk concentrates on how we're ruled over by the capitalist class. And ultimately, I would argue that the power of capital and the fetishism of commodities is the root of this particular class struggle. But I also mentioned that there is something called authority. Now, all human communities must have authority. You have to have a way of saying what is legitimate and illegitimate action. You have to have some way of coordinating. And even in socialism, we will have authority. That is what essentially, as a theoretical idea, distinguishes socialists from anarchists. The idea that we think that authority is necessary and can be benign and can be exercised democratically. And of course, if someone can capture that means of communicating and coordinating, they can disable the capacity of other groups and rivals in society to act against them, and can dominate society, or can at least manipulate and ensure and protect their own interests. So, of course, what I'm arguing, essentially, is in capitalism, it is not the military that predominates. In capitalism, in everyday, actual, ordinary functioning capitalism, although it is the political machinery, it's the political machinery backed up by the golden rule. Them as have the gold rule. Whereas in feudalism, it's them that have the rule, get the gold. And essentially, if we have military intervention in a modern capitalist society, that is not capitalism functioning in its own essential characteristics. That is a crisis within capitalism and a failure of capitalism. And so we cannot realistically talk about real power lying in the armed forces. They are the ultimate part of society. So, as I already mentioned, I'm arguing that the working class has the real power within capitalism. Now, we've all seen within recent years there have been various, some people call them branded or coloured revolutions. There was the Velvet Revolution, the Orange Revolution, there was the Cedar Revolution in the Lebanon, there was a huge revolt in Argentina. In Bolivia, governments have been brought down by mass mobilisations. And it's clear that without at the very least the consent of the working class, No government can rule. The working class have been able to come out on the streets and time again demonstrate that when they act, they are unstoppable. I mean, even in Brazil, where they were slaughtered, not Brazil, Venezuela, where they were essentially slaughtered, they've come back and they've asserted their power. And whether or not we agree with the ins and outs of the Chavista regime, at the very least we know it has a great deal of popular working class support, however critical that is. And of course the difference between feudalism and capitalism is that feudalism does not rely upon the peasants for everyday reproduction of that form of society. It is essentially an intervention in a much more ancient form of village life. What happens in feudalism is you have villages which are, to a great lesser extent, historically speaking, self-sustaining communities, and you have feudal lords which are parasitic and come along and extract surplus from them, and they just come along and they essentially steal it. They do not require any sort of like active cooperation, because once you've stolen their goods, you can assume that they'll go out and they'll fend for themselves and they'll produce more to ensure the continued existence of their village. It's more or less essentially a way of farming. It's based on agriculture. It's like going along to a bee's nest and stealing the honey. Once you've stolen the honey, the bees will make some more for themselves. Well, capitalism doesn't work like that. Capitalism relies on the active participation of the working class day in, day out, to reproduce capitalism and actively keep on making this society. Because we have built everything around us. The working class has created the entirety of the infrastructure of capitalism through the act of cooperation. And if you look at wherever you have a work to rule or a Gauss law, where the working class withdraws its goodwill as part of a labour dispute, production drops dramatically. So there's a great deal of working class effort goes in, free of charge, more or less, to making sure that capitalism keeps on going. And the withdrawal of our labour, fundamentally, means that we have a veto over this society. And the fact that we can control this society in our daily lives means that we can skew the direction in which things are run. Essentially, the working class, we contend, or historically the Socialist Party has contended, runs capitalism from top to bottom. Capitalists these days do not need to have any direct personal control over the affairs of their company. If you are a shareholder in GlaxoSmithKline or in British Gas or in, I think it's Centrica now, isn't it, or in British Telecom or the like, you don't actually need to have any hand in the running of the company. You appoint a senior executive officer who is at least nominally a highly paid worker who runs the firm for you and directs it, and all you have to do is, at the end of the day, you don't even have to invest yourself. You can pay a stockbroker to invest your money, and all you have to ask for at the end is a check, your dividends off your investments. So there's no essentially direct input from the capitalist class. They are no longer essential to the running of their own system. But capital itself, which we fetishise, that continues to be essential, because even if the capitalists didn't want to try and keep on producing more and more profit, capital would demand it of them, and they would be elbowed aside by whoever was able to capitalise or exploit the advantage of the mistakes of their rival capitalists. So we run their system for them, and in fact this system is enforced through the mechanism of the state. Now the state in modern society, there's endless amounts of books and treaties and articles written on the theory and nature of the state. But the state these days is the source of authority. It is the means by which this modern, sprawling, immensely complicated system of society coordinates itself. And what this state does is it enforces the interests of these absentee capitalists. The example I give usually when I'm on the platform at Speaker's Corner is the Bhopal disaster in the 1980s, when Union Carbide, a vast capitalist concern, suffered a catastrophic accident in India, and tens of thousands of people were killed, thousands more were maimed by a release of hydrogen cyanide. Now, apparently, workers at the New York office of Union Carbide were in absolute tears, because they knew what it was about, they knew what they'd done or they were responsible for, but they still had to go out there and deny all responsibility. They had to deny that Union Carbide was at fault, because they had a legal obligation to their shareholders to protect their investments. And that means, ultimately, not admitting liability unless you absolutely have to. course, they didn't absolutely have to, and they fought like demons to avoid any responsibility since. But that was a positive legal duty on their part. So it's the control of the state that now enables the capitalist class to maintain its rule in that sense, alongside the working class's continued collaboration and capitulation to the interest of capital. So the state itself, I mean, some people, some theorists call it the power to define the exception. So he said, killing is bad, except when the government does it, because then it's part of running, keeping society organised. So they have an existential threat. They can kill anyone who disagrees with them. Ultimately, that is what backs the state up, some would argue. Some theorised it in terms of a monopoly of violence. Well, I wouldn't say necessarily it's a monopoly. It's an attempt to gain a monopoly. We can look at types of rivals. One clear rival, a sort of state within a state, was the mafia. Or is the mafia, even. Of course, the mafia behaved in a state-like way. It said, we have a monopoly of violence in this area. You will pay us protection money, and we will make sure your business doesn't get robbed, and we will kill or maim any interlopers or criminals who harm your business for you. We'll also protect you from the police and from other mafia mobsters. That, at least, is the official understanding between the extortion and protection racket. At the present moment, we can see in the Lebanon, we have a state within a state that is Hezbollah. They have quite clearly got a great deal of power there. They have their own army. They've managed to fight a modern, one of the finest military forces on the earth to an apparent standstill, some people claim. I'm not sure. At least they've managed to fight very hard. And they are not the state there. They do not exercise public authority as such. But they have been able to successfully challenge the Lebanese government, which itself has been unable to orchestrate and become the predominant force of violence. So what I'm suggesting here is ultimately that the state itself is the best organised violence going. That's one way you can look at the state. And of course, most people who do not want to get killed will not challenge an efficient, fully functional and organising state. So, and it's through the capacity of organisation. I wrote an article for this month's Social Standard, which talks about the Spanish Civil War. And of course, in the Spanish Civil War, just to throw another example, what happened there was the military revolted against the weak Popular Front government. And of course, the military were better organised and also better trained and had military experience. They were able to prevail ultimately over the richer and possibly more popular Republican government, precisely because, okay, yes, there was lots of international politics in the meanwhile, but in the first days of the war, clearly, it was the military side of the state and its organisation that enabled them to prevail. But again, that was not the functioning of capitalism, that was a retrogression to a stage that hadn't really finished, which was the end of feudalism in Spain and a form of absolutism in the Franco's species of fascism. So, having said that the state is the means by which the capitalist class organises itself, I'm going to present a rough and ready model for how the capitalist class maintains and controls that state. So hopefully you'll be able to read my horrible scrawly handwriting. So I'm going to present, there are three essential, you can call them filters, that enable the capitalist class to control the means of communication and authority, or political communication. The first is the collective ownership and control of the press. The second is the control and ownership of political parties. And the third is the national debt. And they vary in directness, I would say, more or less going down to the most indirect from the most hands-on and overtly political. So, taking the first of these, the press, of course we all know that the press more or less is almost entirely owned, with the exception of BBC, by private capitalist concerns. This much is an obviousness to pretty much everyone in society, including capitalist politicians, like Tony Blair, who made sure that he had Rupert Murdoch on side before he took on the government, because Labour has in the past come to government and found that the press is unrelentingly hostile to everything it does, and they have to fight against privately owned media. But it's not just through the fact that Rupert Murdoch is a private proprietor, or Richard Desmond, the pornographer, is a private proprietor. They own the press collectively. Now, in the second instance, this is through a mechanism of advertising. You cannot run a modern mass media organisation without getting some of your income through advertising. That's absolutely essential. And it forms an effective barrier to market entry. No one can afford it. You can't make that much money from it. The real customer is fellow capitalists. What you are delivering is readers and viewers. You can't really make a profit out of producing a national daily newspaper and just selling it. So collectively through the press, and we hear of various incidents. I think there was one in Canada where I think it was some auto worker, car manufacturer, withdrew advertising. You hear about it occasionally in local newspapers where local councils withdraw advertising. If people take their advertising away from a magazine or a journal, its profits suffer, and therefore it suffers and its owners suffer, and they don't want that to happen. So their fellow capitalists will not exactly police them directly, but if they step out of line, if they no longer like what they're saying, they'll just stop advertising there because they don't want to be associated with that sort of message. But beyond that, we have the fact that there's a billion-dollar industry, or billion-pound industry, in the first instance, not just in advertising, paying for that, but in PR. Firms have massive PR functions. They spread the message. Most news agencies rely upon outside sources to come and give them the news and feed it to them with press releases and priming and contacts. And, you know, you watch the average BBC News 24, they're always contacting universities to find a random academic who can waffle on the subject of the day for half an hour, because they're desperate to fill the airtime. So they depend upon outside agencies. Of course, these agents spend a great deal of money in promoting the interests of their own paymasters, and ultimately the capitalist interests generally. So there's a vast material system of production of communication of ideas going on in favour of capitalism. It's very hard for working class people who can't afford to control these things to meet. So the second level is political parties. Now, this is in part providing the personnel of capitalism. You know, John Major's government largely all went to Cambridge together. In fact, I think a photo of them, half of them at Cambridge in the same cabinet. Certainly John Gummer and Ken Clark in the same Conservative club back then. So that's one way in which they maintain power. But also, of course, the Labour Party itself is a means of socialising, and meaning that capitalists can meet politicians. But it's not just that forming political parties as a sort of network of interests. They own the political parties. In the 2000 election, the Labour Party spent, I think it was £20 million getting elected, about £1, about £2 a vote, probably. And about £10 million of that came from 10 millionaires. Now, half their funding came from millionaires. Now, you don't even have to allege some sort of shady conspiracy here to say that these people would not give £1 million a time for their own abolition. They're simply not going to do it. They're always going to vote with their pounds for policies that, at the very least, are not opposed to their interest, never mind actively in the favour of them. But of course, we know nowadays that modern politics is as corrupt as the 18th century. I've been rattling on about this for years, David Sainsbury, who's given millions upon millions to the Labour Party, and all he's got out of it is a seat in the legislature and a cabinet position in technology, in industry and technology. And of course, he is the owner, or at least his family owns, rather, I think he's divested himself personally into a trust, his family owns a supermarket chain. So, of course, there's no interest whatsoever for a science and technology minister who has to deal with the science and technology of foodstuffs and foodstuff production. No conflict of interest there. But it's not just even David Sainsbury. I mean, we all know about the Lawns for Peerages thing. But not just for the status of it, but also for a chance to get into the legislature by buying their way in. So there's a very material interest going on that reinforces this elite control of the state. And ultimately, there is the most abstruse and abstract one, and one you won't hear mentioned very often, which is the national debt. Now, we've probably all heard about the monetary crises of the Callaghan government and the great devaluation debate. And of course, that was international bankers saying that the British government was no longer effectively solvent and that they had to change their policies in order to restore confidence. And so they gladly did that. Callaghan himself said he was very happy to do what the bankers said. Tony Betts said, "Oh, that's terrible, you've done what the bankers asked you. You've damaged British interests." But of course, there's not even just that example. When Arnold Schwarzenegger took over as the governor of California, the state's finances were so powerless, within a year, its credit rating was downgraded. Now, that might not sound too bad, but if that knocks on an extra 0.5% on the price of borrowing for that state, that runs to millions upon millions of dollars. And any state that sees its borrowing credit, its credit rating fall through, will soon find itself very hard to operate. And of course, this does not mean that the capitalist class sit round in an international financial cabal saying what the policy of governments must be. All it is the very natural ebb and flow of the financial lending markets, where people decide to lend money to a government, sits back and says, "Look, if I lend you my money, I don't think I'm going to get it back. So I'm going to raise the price just to make sure that I get at least some of it back." But of course, that means that so long as you remain within capitalism, the general capitalist interest of profitability must be maintained. So that's three ways in which a tiny handful, based almost entirely every stage you might have noticed, on the ownership of property and the intervention, you can almost say the pound's vote in between elections, that's how the capitalist class maintains control of this mechanism of coordinating within society. Just finally, of course, anyone who's watched a movie, you know, Star Trek, Doctor Who, all these sorts of things, where part of the storyline involves a revolution, will see that the most famous and popular idea is the spark theory, that eventually the state does something so egregious, so terrible, that the population just rises up and swamps it. That's the general idea. The Leninists are very much beloved of that particular theory. And of course, what is going on there is that as things stand, it's very hard to coordinate a revolution. If you want to have this massive change in society, you have to be sure that people won't join in unless it's safe. I think the image you can take away is from your standard Western. I think the particular one I can bear in mind is Kevin Costner and Wyatt Earp, where at the end, he comes out of his office and there's a crowd of a baying mob who want to go in there and lynch one of his prisoners. And he pulls out his gun against hundreds of other people, and he points it and says, "Well, you can take me, but who wants to be the first to die?" And that's the blackmail of the state. It's this very rational choice we make that, although together, acting in a coordinated fashion, we can defeat, say, at any given moment, if people move too soon or people move in the wrong way, the state will win any given small fight. It can't win the overall war, but it could win quite a lot of battles. And if we even win in the end, most people in the average given state of life are not prepared to die for your average cause today. So that's one way the state holds people at bay. The Socialist Party obviously does not go with the spark theory of revolution. Our case is that it is the political consciousness of the working class. And as I've been making clear, although I spent a long time detailing how the capitalist class control their state, they do so almost by the tacit consent or the ideological consent of the working class who are enthralled commodity fetishism. So I suppose one answer really is it's no one has real power, but there is a class war over where that real power should lie. So just to wrap up then, what I think I've demonstrated is that the real power, and real power in capitalism, is the power to abstractly control and set in motion social forces, lies with the working class. But as in all human communities, authority is an essential way for legitimising and controlling any social activity and social movement. The working class does not control the means of authority within capitalism, and that it is not so much the military or the capacity for military force that keeps them at bay, but rather the ideological control of the fetishism of the commodity and the continued acceptance of capitalism. And I've demonstrated a brief model, I think, of how the capitalist class, without resorting to conspiracy theories or cabals or international Zionist monsters with lizard tongues who are really from the dimension of Arcturus or what have you, of how a propertied elite can continue to maintain its own interest without necessarily having to directly and consciously act against us. And I think at the end, I suggested that what we need is a means of organising the working class to change that consciousness and coordinate themselves, and that is why the Socialist Party continues to advocate political activism in order to take control of the state and change it into the, or possibly a, instrument of emancipation. Thank you very much.
I'll now take any questions from the floor on Bill Martin's contribution. If there are any, raise your hand.
I will.
A continual change taking place within capitalism, which involves one group of capitalists being done down by another. For instance, in the United States, about the Great Depression, there was the Bay-Area Act, which put up tariffs for the import of goods, especially anything which was ordered by the government. That has long since been repealed, and the United States is more or less an open market, and the power within the capitalist, you could say, belongs to the multinational companies, especially the oil industry and extractive industries throughout the world, which is available to all sorts of other changes taking place. And so that the capitalist class is not a united entity, but they're constantly at war with each other within the particular states or throughout the world as they operate. So it isn't a cohesive group, if you like. But I would claim that the part of the role of government is to overlook the functioning of capitalism within a particular country it's operating, and try to organise things for the general benefit and welfare of capitalism, which, as Bill said, the capitalists receive their interest in dividend checks, and that's about as interested as getting the actual process of production. So it is a society within turmoil, a tremendous turmoil, not just between worker and capitalist, but with the capitalists themselves.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I probably should have mentioned more on the international side of capitalist power, and certainly they are between states at war with one another almost constantly. I mean, you suggest that the United States has lowered its tariffs, but it hasn't. I mean, within the first Bush term, certainly George Bush risked a trade war with Europe over steel tariffs, and they continually protect their agricultural sector as well. And yes, I mean, free traders would call that one capitalist robbing another, because tariffs and subsidies are a means of distributing profits from one section of the capitalist class to another by non-market means. And they certainly aren't enacting part of what I was trying to get at, was that the capitalist class certainly don't rule as a singular conspiratorial section of society, but that through their competition with each other, with the mechanism of the state as part of the battleground for competition, they still enforce their own interests. So particularly things like national debt, rather than lend to a government, they could lend to a capitalist firm. That would be a shift in the flow of profits. And of course, Marx described the state as the executive committee of the capitalist class. But even within cells, so because the boundaries of the horizons of reality, the real world, that's part of why I banged on about the idea of reality, within the real world and being realistic, any government that comes to power within capitalism is going to want to act in what they would see as the general interest. And the invisible part of the general interest is that the capitalist interest lies behind that. And if you try and act against the capitalist interest, you bring rack and ruin, essentially. That was kind of part of the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Stan?
I really want to question the validity of this statement of this meeting. Where does the real power in capitalism lie? Because I think that question implies a view of society, which, frankly, is not mine. I don't mean I oppose everything. I mean I think there is a conception of power, which maybe Bill shares, that there's a kind of the society itself consists of a number of boxes, if you like, or areas. Whereas I think a better analogy for the understanding of society is that it's not a series of separate things. It is a web or a network of interrelated sources of power, influence, authority, etc. Now, I think this has implications for our understanding of capitalism. I think we do understand that capitalism isn't just a political matter. It is a matter of capitalist ideas. I think your phrase was the production of ideas in favour of capitalism, which clearly is carried on, well, for one thing, in the whole of education, in the whole of the media, in many other spheres. We are daily and comprehensively living in capitalism. Now, the implication for those of us who want to surpass, as I prefer, or abolish, or whatever, who want to move from capitalism to another system, is that we don't just move politically. Very importantly, we do. We are a political party. And I'm not saying we should devalue politics. I'm saying we should recognize it as part of society. So, come the time when there are however many million, 10 million or 20 million of us ready to, if you like, in inverted commas, capture political power, by that time, because society is awake, there will be millions of people with socialist ideas in other spheres, the whole of education, the whole of the media, arts, work and leisure, cultural life, etc. It won't just be politics, and that's really my point. Today it isn't just politics. The change, the revolutionary change we want, won't just be politics. It will be politics in a web of other parts of society, both material and of ideas.
Absolutely. I mean, that was partly what my contribution was trying to get across, and showing my lack of memorising my own talk here. What I left out was, I mean, one of the reasons I introduced the Queen was the idea that although nominally she has this power constitutionally, doesn't use it, and theoretically never could because Parliament would overthrow her. If there was a massive monarchist movement in this country for some reason sitting outside Parliament, then the Queen would win the argument. But it would not be because she was the Queen, it would be because there was a sufficiently militant social group out there who were willing to enforce her view of the Constitution. And of course, ultimately, if a small group of people want to break out of the Constitution, the same thing applies. But with a sufficiently large movement behind you, sharing a comprehensive idea and able to coordinate, then you can enforce it. You say that society is a web, absolutely, but it's also, ultimately, it is a single web, and sometimes there has to be a decision that is binding across the whole thing. And that's where you could say real power lies, is the power to determine what the web is. And as you say, at the present moment, those teachers who are teaching, you know, how to live in capitalism, they're being realistic. They are teaching how people need to live in order to live in our society. And, you know, if someone tried to say, you know, you work in a free association of producers, and, you know, you don't bother getting yourself a job, you just take control of the means of production as they are, they'd be a very lousy teacher because we don't have socialism yet. They have to teach capitalism because that is the real society.
Anybody else like to contribute? Yes.
Marx suggests that capitalism actually, more and more, is hijacking democracy. And if anything, in the Western parts of the world, basically, we have more or less a liberal dictatorship. And that in doing so, they are manipulating the system to show that capitalism is the best of all systems, and that any opposition to it is about a form of, well, as we call it today, terrorism, or the breakup of the whole civilized idea. And that's my contribution at the moment.
Yes, as Ivan says, I mean, increasingly it looks like democracy is highly precarious. In America, I find this quite shocking, George Bush has issued a memorandum saying he reserves the right to determine how he will interpret the laws as the executive will carry them out. So if Congress, as it has, passes a law saying no torture, he says, I reserve the right to interpret that no torture resolution in terms of my implicit powers of being a war president. This is quite shocking. This is a constitutional innovation of the First Order. And likewise, in this country, increasingly, the government is cutting back democracy in favour of a sort of managerialism. Now, partly that is that, you know, in order to run this vastly complex system of society, they need to draw workers in to run the system for them. And to get workers to run it in their interests is very difficult, because obviously, if you put working class people in positions of authority, they'll try and execute the interests of themselves and their fellows. So they're caught in this bind that they need democracy to keep us on board, to stop rival capitalists being able to monopolise the state. They need to have political democracy as well. But by the same token, they can't trust this system. And they're trying to find new ways of dealing with that. And possibly that might well give. Partly, I think, you could see Marx and Engels' theory. In some senses, you could argue that their idea would be, you know, way back when a Labour government, a genuine workers' movement, no longer composed of capitalists, just by its very nature, it would legislate in favour of the working class and push interests of capital back. And of course, it hasn't proved to be quite that way, but certainly each time the government is always having to concede something to the workers and the workers' interest in order to keep them on board continually. In order to maintain the dominance of the capitalist class. And that's partly where political disputes lie to this day, I think.
Michael?
Why do some political parties hate the state? For instance, the Tory party, the state intervention, you know, they didn't like it, although they control, they are part of the state.
Why do some parties hate the state? Well, obviously, the state itself has a material basis. There's a vested interest in the state. You know, there are all these council officials, state officials who want to keep themselves in a job and who would like to expand their own personal empires. So there's a rivalry, in some sense, between private and state capitalism. And then, of course, as Joe Back said, there's an dispute between different capitalist interests as to how to run capitalism in their own interest. So they fight it out. And of course, there are ideologues and strange ideas on the left in socialism circles. So there are on the right. Of course, some of these people have an easier time of getting into parliament, because obviously, if you're a multimillionaire anarcho-capitalist, you can propound your ideas a lot more effectively. And find a ready market for yourself, or minarchists, I think some of them call themselves. And of course, capitalists themselves naturally dislike regulation. Of course, they like their rivals to be regulated, but they don't want to be regulated, and they have to walk this tightrope between their general interest of enforcing the interests on themselves, health and safety regulations, as opposed to making profits individually. That's part of what forms politics today. And of course, the working class come in and they say, well, look, we want this, we want that. And even if it is an argument of a reformist type within capitalism, the way to the workers can shift and decide things for the capitalists. So the Tories said that they wanted to win over the working class. They said, we'll sell you your council houses. Of course, like I said, another quote similar to the one about paying one half to put the other half down. Any government that promises to rob Peter to pay Paul can count on the support of Paul. And essentially, it's, you know, there is no static model of the state and the society. It's all in flux. And whenever we try and draw a chart like that on the board, that is just a simplifying way of trying to understand these incredibly complex things. There'll probably be someone could probably stand up today and give me a contradiction and say, well, that's not true. The government did this, that, or the other. The capitalist class tried to stop, and they got it through. But ultimately, what we're talking about is trends and general aspects that we can identify, rather than perhaps a universal, hard and fast law of nature about how capitalist politics works.
If you have time for one more brief contribution, I know that there are some new faces in the audience. Do any new visitors have a comment? Yes.
Yeah. Hi. I'd just like to throw some situation out there. In most capitalist societies, I think most would agree that we have the strong and the weak, the haves and the have-nots, and the haves generally share common values amongst themselves about extending their remit of power or domain, and so we use the banner as capitalism in order to shelter a certain way of thinking or value system within our societies. So my question is not to say whether I agree that capitalism is a good thing or a great evil or a great good for the society in which capitalism is able to flourish, but do you think it's a great evil, or it can be used as a great good in some societies, capitalism?
Oh, right. You're asking me, can capitalism be progressive and beneficial? Obviously, our answer is that we generally like the fact that capitalism has existed because it makes socialism possible. And I personally would not want to be a feudal peasant. And I've done reasonably well out of capitalism. I have every prospect of living to be 80 years old or something like that, you know, on average, possibly even longer, you know, you never know, possibly shorter. I guarantee these things. But we're not doing too badly at it. But by the same token, as a worldwide system, I think it's every 2 years more people, there's millions more millions dying of starvation, starvation-related diseases. There are half the world's population doesn't have proper sanitation. 1.2 billion people don't have clean drinking water. I mean, you know, you can reel these stats off. It's that it's shown us the way forward. It's taught us how to... It's done the hard work of socialising the means of production. It's taken us to this stage. All we need to do is finish the job and finish the job and remove the fact that it's running the interest of the capitalist class, turn it in our own interest. So you can say it's a good and a bad thing. But the point we'd say is that capitalism already exists worldwide, and there's no need to promote it in any society. It already exists in every society on earth. And what remains now is to continue the job of developing the world, but that we think we need socialism to push it forward, because capitalism ultimately, and the interest of the capitalist class, is holding back valid production.
Okay, it's now about 1453, so I think it's a good time to break, and we'll reconvene in about 15 minutes, so at shortly after 3 o'clock, I guess, maybe 3:05. Okay.